From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, hear from the candidates for mayor in Kansas City, Kansas, and memories of JJ's restaurant, destroyed in Tuesday's gas explosion on the plaza.
It sort of evoked Kansas City as a cosmopolitan, interesting, vibrant city that other restaurants on the plaza really didn't do.
A group of parents in Waldo and Brookside get their wish, a new public school.
And a 160-year-old Catholic school in Independence closes. Plus, how parents can do the unthinkable.
When you remove a child from someone they love, there's grief and loss associated with that, traumatic grief and loss of that child from the parent who maybe was the abuser.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. On Tuesday, voters in Wyandotte County will narrow the field of candidates for the mayor, CEO of the unified government. The number running will be reduced from 5 to 2 going into the April general election. KCUR's Dan Verbeck reports on candidates' backgrounds and issue positions that have emerged since the campaign began in earnest only a month ago.
Campaign styles are not all the same, but there is nothing half-hearted about the passion to take the mayor's seat being vacated by Joe Reardon. Three of the hopefuls sit on the Unified Government Commission. Most hold down separate jobs as well. There is a clergyman, owner of a business. One candidate runs a nonprofit community agency. Two are women, three are men. They appeared in a forum to answer questions and to introduce themselves. Nathan Barnes says he's represented the Northeast District since 1995. He wants to bring to the entire county the kind of resurrection of the old Northeast area.
When I came to office, we had not built, there had not been one single new housing permit built in the Northeast area for over 40 years.
Now, he says, $75 million worth of development. There is still plenty of blight visible in the old Northeast side. Mark Holland is senior pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church, said he has the ability to move the county to a new level since it consolidated government 16 years ago. His plan is to find relief from property taxes and make neighborhoods healthier. Cordell Meeks owns a corporate training firm and chairs the Unified Government Human Relations Commission, his first step into running for office.
I've also spent over 20 years working with organizations to improve the community here. I've served on dozens of boards. I've taught as a teacher in the school district here.
Anne Merguia mingles her job as a commissioner on unified government with that of executive director of the Argentine Neighborhood Development Commission. She's done that for nearly 6 years and says can put the experience to use as mayor by bringing together sparring interests. Janice Witt describes herself as just a countyan. She wants to return to customer service, as she puts it, for all citizens. She holds a master's degree in hospitality management.
There's been a lot of infighting and divisiveness that has carried over into our overall dysfunction in our county leadership.
And so the introductions. All five candidates debated finance last week on Up to Date, answering questions posed by Steve Kraske and listeners. The question was whether the highly blighted eastern part of the county can find the same prosperity as the thriving west around Kansas Speedway. Mark Holland thinks it's taken a generation for the deterioration east of I-635 to take hold.
And my belief is it's going to take a generation for it to be completely turned around. But that gives us a sense of urgency that we need to start right now with the redevelopment of the infrastructure, the redevelopment of the housing and the businesses.
Holland calls it strategically seeding success.
The next two most important strategic investments that we need to make, I believe, are in our downtown and in Indian Springs. The Indian Springs at I-635 and I-70 is an eyesore. We're emptying it out so we can push it over and redevelop that area. And we need to continue to take the fruit of the Western Wyandotte development that's been so successful and continue to plant it around our community.
Barnes sees a connection between east and west, and success in the outer reaches is bound to translate into financial aid for the poverty-stricken parts. Merguia, too, is worried at a rapid reduction in the tax base in impoverished areas. Janice Witt blames the three sitting commissioners who are running for mayor as part of the problem.
But we need to be able to spread
the generous amount of positive atmosphere that there is at the Legends area throughout the entire county. My concern is not what we're going to do. We have to build. In order to build, we have to have a solid foundation. In order to have that foundation, we have to be clear on what got us where we are. And what got us where we are, not to be accusatory, but are the people who are sitting around this table at this panel.
None of the commissioner mayoral candidates rose to that, saying the problems are too entrenched over too long, but all agree the starting time for renewal is now. Meeks believes the aging Central City can change, as has Kansas City, Missouri's downtown, with River Market and loft apartments, and it'll take time. Every one of the candidates for mayor, each in their own way, is eyeing the expected windfall from a hotel tax and sales tax generated out of development in the western part of the county. It's now going to pay back state bonds that finance the Cerner Corporation Office Park and the Sporting Park Stadium. When it arrives, most candidates would use it to cut property taxes. Barnes says he can restore the inner city and lower property taxes at the same time with creative budgeting. He worries the state, though, is going to find a way to siphon off that windfall. Murguia isn't certain the windfall will actually fall, but blames local government for the property tax level now.
Over the last 8 years, the property tax in Wyandotte County has been raised by $7 million. To me, that's ridiculous, and that is absolutely an impediment to what we're trying to do in the way of economic development.
The five have been spending a lot of time trying to make their mark on voters. The primary election is Tuesday. Two candidates will survive. The general election is April 2nd. I'm Dan Verbeck, KCUR News.
The five candidates for mayor in Kansas City, Kansas, also debated the issues last Monday on Up to Date. Hear that debate in full on our website, kcur.org.
Local and federal officials are trying to piece together exactly what happened last Tuesday evening when a natural gas leak led to an explosion just west of the Country Club Plaza. The explosion and resulting fire at JJ's restaurant killed one woman and injured more than a dozen people. As of late last week, five were still in the hospital. The victim is presumed to be 46-year-old Megan Kramer. She's a native of Springfield and a longtime resident of the Plaza area. She had been working at JJ's for only a few months, but had come from another Plaza restaurant, which may be why Kansas City's entire restaurant community seemed to feel the loss. The day after the explosion, JJ's co-owner Jimmy Francais was at the site. He had a hard time looking at the burned-out shell of a building that used to be his restaurant.
I've had this restaurant for 28 years. It was a big part of my life. So that's why I'm facing this way, not facing that way, because I don't want to look at it.
While Francais surveys the loss, various agencies are investigating the events leading up to the explosion, which was caused when construction workers laying fiber optic cable pierced a gas line shortly before 5 p.m. They called the fire department. But fire officials were called off when workers from Missouri Gas Energy arrived shortly after. The fire department is expected to issue their report on the explosion this week. A deeper investigation will be conducted by the Missouri Public Service Commission, which regulates MGE, and by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Meanwhile, the other co-owner of JJ's restaurant has one word to describe his employees: heroes. We'll hear from some of those employees and regulars in a few minutes. But first, KCUR's Peggy Lowe reports on how those bartenders, busboys, a hostess, and others were the last ones out of that burning building.
They didn't know it at the time, but for JJ's workers, that 1 hour from 5 to 6 o'clock on Tuesday evening was a countdown to chaos. Dave Francais, co-owner of JJ's with his brother Jimmy, says the restaurant's manager was working in the wine vault earlier in the day, so he and other employees didn't smell the gas until mid-afternoon. By 5 o'clock, they received the first of several visits by fire and utility officials.
But it was the fire department sometime around 5 o'clock saying, just open the doors up and let it air out.
A few minutes later, the fire department came back to tell those in the restaurant that they were waiting for Missouri Gas Energy to get a backhoe so the utility could fix the problem. Then around 5:30, MGE officials came into the restaurant and told JJ's manager, Matt Nichols, that the backhoe had arrived and they would soon start digging.
And Matt said then, shortly after that, another group from the people from MGE came back in with these sensor tester sniffer stir things and said, the levels are too high, you need to evacuate everybody.
That was roughly 5:45. So the workers went table to table and person to person in the bar and told patrons to leave. With everyone out, the workers were trying to evacuate when the building blew up at about 6 o'clock. We now know it was 6:04. A fireball can be seen in surveillance video erupting from the site, and residents blocks away said the explosion was so powerful it felt like an earthquake. JJ's building was collapsing on the workers.
Our general manager, Matt, said that the wall, he just kind of outraced the wall as it came down on him. And our folks behind the bar indicated similar stories that the wall had was coming on to them as they were trying to get out.
One of those workers didn't make it out. The last few to get out of the burning building had to climb over a pile of debris lodged in the front door. Dave Francais has a word for that.
They are heroes. You know, they got every single, they got every single patron out of there. And they did what they were supposed to do. You know, these aren't trained emergency service providers. These are waiters and busboys and cooks and managers and bartenders, and they took care of every single customer and got them out of there. I think that's pretty miraculous.
Peggy Lowe, KCUR News.
I'm Alana Gordon, here a few blocks from JJ's on the plaza. Judging by the lineup at the bar of this place, you'd think we were at JJ's. A lot of regulars have met up at Colvine's the night after the fire, including Jim Potter.
You know, we just wanted to come out and show them that we supported them, we care about them. I mean, we're concerned about their well-being.
The community surrounding JJ's is a close-knit bunch. Kevin T., Deanna Farbstein, again Jim Potter, and Patty Nast, all regulars, reflect on what the restaurant has meant to them.
We lost a fun place. It was as comfortable as any human being could ever ask to be comfortable when they left their home.
It is definitely the place where deals happen, people meet. Every time you go in, you see at least 7 people that you know.
I think I'm kind of a newcomer to JJ's as far as the regulars go. I've been only down there for about 15 years. And, you know, it's kind of like family.
Patty, can you fill anything else in?
It was Cheers.
Great Cheers bar.
Yeah, it was our corner bar.
A lot of people, staff especially, are still in shock and find it difficult to talk about what happened. This is a place for them to gather, and area restaurants have provided dinner. Jim Ligon wasn't working at JJ's Tuesday night, but he's been a bartender there for several years.
I honestly don't think I've really processed the fact that JJ's is gone. It's weird looking at the footage today and seeing, like, just everything in rumbles, you know, and thinking, like, wow, I was just there on the patio having a drink, you know, and now it's gone.
For Ligon, JJ's was more than a paycheck.
It's the kind of place where I definitely look forward to going to work every day because I know exactly who I would see. I knew exactly what they were drinking. We get to talk about their days and their weekend, and, you know, it's like just catching up with friends more than a job, you know.
Ligon was at home when the explosion happened, but he said he could imagine exactly who was there hanging out that evening. It was that kind of place. Ligon says since then, being able to connect with the JJ's community has been essential. He and others formed a command center at a bar in Westport during the day and have turned to each other as they try to come to terms with what happened and the death of a colleague.
So today has just been catching up with people. You know, obviously our thoughts are with Megan Kramer and her family. Undeniable loss, but also focused on the fact that it could have been so much incredibly worse, and feel fortunate for the people that did make it out and the people that we do have today, and happy that they're all getting treatment and getting, you know, or in better condition today, in better spirits.
Ligon says he and others have also found comfort in the hundreds of Facebook notes and text messages they've received from people in support. There have been several fundraising efforts, too. One thing he's not worried about, future employment. A lot of area businesses have reached out to JJ's staff.
Just so many job offers, you know. It just sucks that we're not going to be all together, you know.
Even so, Ligon says he and others are committed to preserving the spirit of the JJ's community. Reporting for KC Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
Food critic Charles Ferruza hadn't been to JJ's in a couple of years, but he told me that the loss is significant to Kansas City's restaurant scene. We sat down a couple of days after the explosion.
JJ's is one of the last independently owned restaurants on the Country Club Plaza. There used to be lots of them, and over the last, I would say definitely the last decade, there are fewer and fewer and fewer independently owned restaurants on the plaza. And this one had its own character, its own style. It was independent in every possible way.
What did it look like?
Like a charming New York-style bistro.
I'm embarrassed to say that I had never been there.
Well, I hadn't been actually in a long time, but I always liked going there because the service was very good. It was very congenial and very comfortable, and you were always made to feel special there.
And it had a real set of regulars.
I think there were regulars that had been going there and sitting in the same bar stools or sitting in the same table since 1985 when the restaurant opened. I mean, it did have people that loved it so much that they went often, sometimes maybe once or twice a week.
And what was it known for?
It was known for its superb wine list, a legendary wine list. It was known for, they had some dish, and I'm hoping I'm getting this right. I only ate it five or six times, an appetizer called tuxedo shrimp that was so delicious. I'd like to have some right now, actually, that I hope when Jimmy reopens the restaurant, that's the first thing I would want to eat, the tuxedo shrimp.
And it was a place that people would want to take out-of-town guests to?
I used to take some out-of-town guests when I had out-of-town guests. I would like to take them to JJ's because it sort of evoked Kansas City as a cosmopolitan, interesting, vibrant city that other restaurants on the plaza really didn't do.
And I understand that some of that was due to Jimmy Francais, the owner.
Jimmy Francais is one of the most charismatic, charming, interesting restaurateurs in the city. He really loves the restaurant business, and he really loves his customers. I've never seen a restaurateur so kind to his customers.
So what's the loss to Kansas City?
Well, I think it's a great loss, and I think it's a great loss for the Country Club Plaza. I think the fact that Jimmy Francais and the employees of JJ's had to put up with that ridiculous mess across the street for so long.
That was the West Edge Plaza, which was originally going to be the Bernstein Rain Building and then became a new project.
And seemingly has taken forever and ever and ever to finish. And it really did, I believe, hurt JJ's business for a long, long time. And, the fact that this happened now makes it a double tragedy.
And you mentioned that wine collection that's lost, too.
And can never be replaced. I'm sure it can never be replaced. And I think that's a horrible loss for Kansas City, and especially a loss for wine lovers who loved going there.
Do you know if the servers there had a particular relationship with each other that doesn't exist at other restaurants, or is it really emblematic of?
I think it's more emblematic. I think every great restaurant has a serving staff that operates as a well-oiled machine, that really fabulous teamwork. And a lot of the servers and bartenders, I should say, and managers at JJ's had been there for a long, long time and cared a lot for each other and really were a wonderful team. And the loss of that team, I think, is just a horrible tragedy.
That was Charles Ferruza, who reviews restaurants for The Pitch and hosts KCUR's Food Critics on Central Standard Fridays.
Coming up, parents in Waldo and Brookside have gotten the okay to reopen a Kansas City, Missouri school. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Over the past several months, Kansas Cityans were shocked by a couple of high-profile cases of child abuse. A couple left their mentally ill teenager handcuffed in the basement with little food. And back in July, another couple was accused of locking a 10-year-old girl in a closet. To hear about how these situations can possibly happen, we spoke last week with social worker Joe Beck, who's the vice president of the Midwest Foster Care and Adoption Association. This week, we hear more from that interview. This mother seemed to single out one of her three children to abuse. Tell us about that dynamic, since you've had a lot of experience working with families.
Frequently, whenever a single child has been targeted, there's something about that child that the parent identifies as the cause of the problem. Maybe it's who that child's father is or mother is. Sometimes it's those children's specific behaviors. But they sort of target this loss of control and associate that with this specific child. And in an effort to create a balance back in their life, they target that child, and they become the victim of abuse in that situation.
Now, this case has raised a lot of questions about the child abuse system. Back in February of 2006, this mother admitted that she withheld food from LP because she was concerned that the girl was going to the bathroom too often. And at that point, the state took custody. But the family was reunified then in 2007. So I guess my question is, what about family reunification? How do they really know that a family is suitable for having a child reunified?
I think family reunification is a challenging area for public child welfare professionals. There are some indicating factors that lead social workers and the courts to believe that parents have rehabilitated or have learned the skills necessary to provide for a child. One of the challenges with family reunification is all too frequently there's not enough follow-up to see what happens after the case is closed. Once the court is no longer involved in these families' lives, who's tracking and watching to see that they're continuing to apply the skills? One of the factors that we believe is critical in family reunification is a parent's ability to accept responsibility for their own behaviors. What was the thing that I did that caused my child to come into state's custody? And how can me and my resources solve that problem and other similar problems in the future? I think all too frequently the system is overburdened. There's not enough social workers out there to follow every case. And when parents meet the demands of the court, I think all too frequently they're left to their own devices, and sometimes they learn to fly under the radar so that they're not noticed again. I don't know the specifics of LP's case, but I do know that she was reunified, and it appears that there wasn't enough done to follow up and make sure that she was indeed safe.
Yeah, because a month after unification, it said that she kind of disappeared, and there wasn't any follow-up. Now, the other thing that was interesting in this case was the LP disappeared completely from school. So what is the role of the school in following up when a student just leaves school, not heard from? And this was a five-year period we're talking about.
Schools have a responsibility to report suspected abuse and neglect. Missouri has mandated reporter laws that indicate who's required to report. I don't know if the school did indeed report the absences, but a lot of times parents will figure out ways to answer those questions, saying that they moved with a relative out of state or they moved into a different school district. And again, the state has finite resources in following up on some of these issues. So it's definitely a challenge to ensure that kids are safe whenever parents have learned how to work through the system and answer the standard questions.
There are a number of cases in child abuse reports about boyfriends, the role of boyfriends. And the case of LP was no exception. The boyfriend was charged recently for contributing to the abuse. What dynamic do you see with these boyfriends in terms of the role they play in abuse situations?
I think it varies depending on the specific case. Sometimes the boyfriends step into these situations and the parent is managing a situation and it's not their child, so they're resistant to comment. Frequently, again, abuse is about power and control, and parents looking to create a balance in their life. It's not unusual for single parents to be looking to have a second income earner in their home or having a romantic relationship that contributes to the balance in their life. So adding the challenges of relationship dynamics on top of an already challenging parenting situation can be very difficult. So sometimes the boyfriends may become the disciplinarian or the abusers. The mom says, my kid's out of control and I need some help. And so the boyfriends will step up and become that disciplinarian. The unfortunate thing is there's no history with the child or parental tie. And statistics tell us that children are far more likely to be abused by people who they're not biologically related to. So I think that creates a unique challenge.
Are there other factors that we should be thinking about in terms of what caused parents to abuse children?
The parents' own childhood and what their experiences were growing up. We learn to parent by the people who parented us, and we tend to repeat the same mistakes of our mothers and fathers. So depending on what those parents' child own experiences were in being raised can contribute to that. We also have to look at the expectations of the parent. Do they understand what kids should be doing at different times? Do they understand developmentally what is a kid supposed to know and understand? We have to look at support. What's going on in this family? A lot of times families lack the support and the resources to solve their own problems. And I think that is a huge contributor. We can't overlook the influences of alcohol and drugs. Parents who consume alcohol or use illicit substances have reduced inhibition. So maybe they have some understanding of where the line is not to cross. But then using drugs and alcohol a lot permits them to cross that line without much thought. And then last but not least, what's going on with the child themselves? What psychological problems may the child have or developmental issues that they have? That's kind of a twofold impact because parents have to go through a grief and loss period. When we think about parents who are becoming parents with a new baby, they have expectations and they want their child to be a certain way. But then when that child's born and maybe they have some unique challenges, parents can go through a grieving period and a loss period that they're no longer going to achieve their dreams of parenthood with this specific child. The flip side of that is they have additional needs that your typical child doesn't have. And so trying to find a way to meet those needs with your limited resources can be challenging and can push parents right over the edge, so out of control that they try to control their children in an attempt to have equilibrium in their lives.
Now, we've all heard about the unfortunate aftermath of abuse and the impact that it has on children. Are the severity of the symptoms that child abuse leaves for a child tied to the severity of the initial abuse?
I think it depends. Each case is so unique. What we know about trauma is that the amount of support that someone receives right after a trauma reduces the long-term impact. In our child welfare system, we move in to protect children. We take them out of abusive situations. And what we're finding as we watch this more and more is that that removal sometimes creates additional trauma that the child now has to overcome. A lot of times kids who are in adverse living environments have no idea that what they're experiencing isn't typical or normal. Their family culture says this is how this is supposed to happen. So one of the unique challenges now for the child welfare system is really understanding the impacts of the trauma of the abuse, but also understanding the impacts of the trauma of the removal from abuse and a placement in a different family living environment where maybe now their needs are being met and they're experiencing positive parenting for the first time. That can be very difficult for kids when they're not used to that and they don't expect it. And we can't forget kids love their parents because they are their parents. There is a bond between children and their parents that can't be replicated. So when you remove a child from someone they love, there's grief and loss associated with that, traumatic grief and loss of that child from the parent who maybe was the abuser. And I think a lot of times that's difficult for people who have not been through the experience to understand.
Now, as we think about remedies, one of the things that was helpful in both of these cases is that someone hotlined these cases. But isn't it the case that sometimes people are really reluctant to get involved and make that hotline call?
Sure. In our society today, we frequently live in our own little isolated silos. We get up and we go to work and we manage our own balance and our own equilibrium. We don't know who our neighbors are. We don't spend a lot of time as a social community. And when we live like that, it's difficult to offer support to somebody that you don't know. So they're resistant to call. I don't want to get involved. It's not my problem. But what we are finding as a society is it is our problem. It creates social problems that we're going to have to address as a community as a whole.
Recently, there's a new joint committee on child abuse and neglect that involves a number of Missouri senators, and I know the goal is to improve child welfare. Based on your experience, what would you tell them about improving the system? We've talked about some of the gaps.
I think that we have to look at the finite resources that are available to support families. There's a huge push in Missouri now on early education, which is absolutely critical for kids to be set up to be successful. But we also have to look at the realities of our economic times. Families who are struggling with finances are much more likely to struggle with power and control issues within their home. Stress is one of the leading factors in predicting whether or not a child will be abused, and one of the leading influences in a family's measuring family stress is their economic status. We need to do more to support the families and to ensure that they have an access to services. And the access needs to be non-judgmental. People change their behavior because of relationships. And so we have to create a system where social workers and helpers work to develop and build positive relationships in a non-judgmental way to help alleviate the barrier for accessing services.
Joe Beck, thank you for being with us today on KC Currents.
Thank you.
Social worker Joe Beck is the vice president of the Midwest Foster Care and Adoption Association. You can hear the first part of this interview on the KC Currents page of our website at kcur.org.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Back in October, we met a group of young parents working to get Kansas City Public Schools to reopen an old elementary school in the Waldo neighborhood. The Friends of Hale Cook had been working for over 2 years to get support from the community and gauge the interest of young families. The group's chair, Ashley Han, explained why.
I came to Kansas City as an advocate for sustainability and urban development that benefits kind of social equity across communities, and viable public school system is the most important thing to the success of our city and the long term, both for economic development, but also for social equity and other issues that I think our city currently faces.
Well, last Friday, February 15th, the KCMO district agreed to the plan and said it would soon start accepting applications to Hale Cook Elementary for this fall. The school will start with just 3 classes, 2 kindergarten classes and 1 first grade, about 60 to 75 students. The school will add a new grade each year until they have a full K through 6. The 1920s era building needs some renovation before it can open its doors to students. So while that's happening, classes will take place at the Hartman Elementary School building, about 1.5 miles away. To find out more about the plan, KC Currents' Alex Smith spoke with Friends of Hale Cook leaders Ashley Hand and Sarah Darmitzel. Darmitzel started by explaining the result of the group's survey of young families.
Well, we got over 500 responses to our survey, and that's responses per household, so that's not necessarily number of students. They don't all have kids, all of the responses that we got, but we were seeing pretty steadily for the next 4 to 5 years, it appeared that about 50 people would commit. So that was people, I mean, nobody knows prior to this day if they'll have a 5-year-old 5 years from now. So that's about as far out as you can possibly survey, but even people with 2 and 3 months old were taking our survey now and were saying, yes, I would be interested in sending my kid there in 4 to 5 years. So around 50 students seemed pretty good from our our study and pretty steady for the next years, that we could attract 50 new students, about 2 classrooms per grade level.
As far as bringing in teachers, you know, it's not uncommon for teachers to try to find jobs like in the outer suburban schools. Do you worry or think there might be any trouble with attracting like high quality teachers to KCMO in a school that's just getting started like this?
We have had teachers involved in this process from the very beginning and their community members themselves. And I think there is a real interest in teaching in a school in the neighborhood. So I hope that we will attract some very talented teachers who will work in partnership with the parents and community members supporting the school. So I think we're pretty excited because I think we'll see a lot of people looking at us to see if they could come here and work with us. So
when we last talked, the group was still kind of figuring out the costs of renovating and reopening the building. Do you know what the final costs of reopening the whole building are going
to
be?
We don't know in detail. We're continuing to work with the district. As soon as they know, have for sure the minimum number of students enrolled, they'll really start that clock to do the detailed construction schedule of what needs to be done and when, and we continue to communicate with them and try to be in the loop and share with the public and the families that will be involved what we know, and we'll continue to try to work with the district and do all that we can to help see the best schedule that we think possible can happen.
As a building that was mothballed in 2009, there's obviously some deferred maintenance, but the district has always planned to bring this school back. So what we've done is accelerated that process by finding the students to help bring that building back.
Now, is the building going to be renovated in stages, or is this just going to happen all at once?
You know, that's not terribly clear just yet. There has been talk about finding tenants to co-locate in the building to help with some of the overhead costs that might be associated with opening a building, which will be small in the students served at the start. So I think as we get those numbers locked in, the district will continue to be working on their plan. And I think what they have felt is that, and not to speak on behalf of the district, but the impression I've been getting is if they do it, they want to do it right from the first time. So don't have children occupying a construction site. Let's just get all this work done. So and my impression would be that they want to try to get the building up to the standard before students are in the building itself.
Your husband, Gunnerhan, since we talked, was elected to the school board in November. What's been his role with the Hale Cook Project?
Well, you know, he was an avid supporter during his campaign and was very honest about, you know, being an advocate for Hale Cook, and actually did everything that he needed to do in his due diligence to ensure there was no conflict of interest as a board member. But as this never went to the board fully for approval. It was approved by a board subcommittee. But Gunner has been willing to step up for us and has been an advocate and a spokesperson for what we've been doing. But we've kind of kept it at an arm's length from each other because this is something that I've been very heavily involved with for almost 2.5 years now. And he has continued to support us and I think will be helpful in getting the word out to a very broad constituency that will be served by Hale Cook.
As I understand, the school will not have busing, so I assume that most of the students will come from this Brookside, Waldo neighborhood. And I'm wondering, is Hale Cook an attempt to bring in more, you know, middle and even upper-class families to the Kansas City, Missouri district?
Well, actually, that's a really interesting question because that's actually something that we have, as friends of Hale Cook, started to understand a little bit better with the help of the district. So what we've done, the original proposal under Dr. Covington did not include busing. But what we've done is we've been very excited by the proposed catchment area that would be outside of the mile and a quarter, I believe.
Mile and a half
radius that would allow students who maybe live a little bit further out but are still part of our community to get bus transportation to school. So we'll be going a little bit further east. That will allow us to catch some students out towards Paseo that would need access to transportation. So what we see as a huge opportunity in this area specifically around Hale Cook and north of Hale Cook has been traditionally non-participatory in our public school system. We have a very low percentage, as we know, that attend public schools. So we absolutely see this as an opportunity to capture those students. But we also want to see an integrated and diverse student population. So the catchment area has been drawn to hopefully create a very dynamic student population that will be reflective of our city and also be a great way of building relationships across the community as we get ready for Southwest.
Because Hale Cook will have, you know, these pretty small class sizes to start out and is drawing from largely a neighborhood that has a middle-class population, is the school providing students with opportunities that students in other KCMO schools don't have?
You know, we will have a traditional curriculum. So the curriculum that you'll see in Hale Cook will be the same as is in most of the kind of traditional curriculum schools, so it won't be a Montessori model or some of the language immersion programs that you see in other district schools. But we will have an opportunity with Friends of Hale Cook to organize parents and community members around getting involved in the education of the children in the community. And we're very excited because with things like Google Fiber coming up and looking forward to the future of where these children will eventually go to middle school and high school, we see this opportunity of creating sister school relationships where we could create cross-programming. So leveraging the resources that we have in our neighborhoods across multiple schools, but also really driving home what the strengths of Kansas City are. We've got some incredible talent here. You know, we've got the arts and entrepreneurial spirit and all these great things going on with technology that if we can start creating ways of bringing that into the classroom, it should and could be replicated across multiple schools.
Ashley Hand and Sarah Darmitzel are leaders of Friends of Hale Cook. They spoke to Casey Currents, Alex Smith. Kansas City Public Schools are already accepting applications for kindergartners and first graders to begin this fall.
After the break, it's the end of an era for another school. This one's a Catholic school in Independence. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. A week ago Friday, St. Mary's High School Gymnasium in Independence saw its final four basketball games. The Catholic Diocese of Kansas City St. Joseph announced last month that the school will close at the end of the school year because of declining enrollment. St. Mary's has been around for 160 years. On the day of those final games, the captain of the cheerleaders, a senior, shares her thoughts. Her name is Emily Ecklin. If that name sounds familiar, she's the daughter of KCUR sports contributor Greg Ecklin.
Good luck on your quiz.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
I'm thinking about how it's going to be the last basketball game that I will cheer at or any game I will cheer at.
17th Amendment, what year? Come on, you're on a roll, kiddo. Help her out, Em.
The teachers at St. Mary's are always really hardworking, and they are some of the best teachers around. I am sure that they are even more upset than some of the students are just because they've been around St. Mary's for a lot longer than students or families have.
Mr. Yazel's quote today, things turn out best for those who make the best of the way things turn out. Please stand for the closing prayer.
We have a lot of activities to get through. Ask all spectators to head to a seat, please.
At first I was nervous, but then once I saw everyone coming in and that had come to support the teams, it was a really good feeling just knowing that everyone was there.
Tonight we want to give young ladies who are in grade school or in junior high who always wanted to play on this court the opportunity to come down on this court. So if you're a grade schooler or a junior high student that wants to be on this court, please come down right now and the cheerleaders will show you where to stand.
I think that was one of the most emotional parts of the night. My little sister is in sixth grade and I know that she was hoping to one day go to St. Mary's and eventually become alumni like my brother and I. She could even play volleyball or do cheerleading there and just kind of live on what we started, and so it was upsetting that she can't do that. It's sad that that was the last game ever, and it was sad for me that that was my last cheerleading event that I'll ever cheer at. But it's sweet because better things are coming, like graduation for us seniors, and then just trying to make better memories for the underclassmen as the final 3 months of school get underway.
That was Emily Ecklin, daughter of KCUR's Greg Ecklin, cheering for the last basketball games ever at St. Mary's High School. The school closes in May.
The entire St. Mary's community is reeling from what they feel was an abrupt decision to close their 160-year-old school. Many families in Independence, Sugar Creek, and Blue Springs are alums and have children and grandchildren there. The Diocese of Kansas City St. Joseph says closing the school was strictly a business decision. They couldn't pay the bills to keep the school open. The reason, they say, is the tumbling enrollment. Only 7 students enrolled for the 2013-2014 freshman class. KCUR's Laura Ziegler has more on the community reaction.
The St. Mary's community in Independence, Blue Springs, and Sugar Creek is devastated, even angry their school's closing. But the fate of St. Mary's is part of a nationwide decline in enrollment in Catholic schools. In Kansas City, the number's gone down from 13,000 to 11,500 since 2004, according to the Diocese of Kansas City St. Joseph. There are lots of reasons for this. There are fewer religious families, and it's an economy that makes it harder for families to afford the tuition. But this diocese also has a boatload of legal expenses related to a child pornography case against one of its priests. Bishop Robert Finn was later indicted in what prosecutors believed was a cover-up of the crime. The cost to the diocese, a reported $1.4 million.
The parents realized that St. Mary's has lost money in the last few years, but there's been a lot of money spent in the diocese on other things that are not related to education.
That's the 14-year mayor of Sugar Creek, Stan Salva. He himself is a graduate of St. Mary's School. He has 3 sons who went there and a bunch of grandkids there now. He says families might feel better about the closing of St. Mary's if they had more respect for the diocese officials.
The money that the diocese had to spend in order to offset all of these scandals, all the lawyers' fees, those kind of monies could have been used to assist, promote, and aid Catholic education in the diocese.
Well, anytime you close a school, it's sad, especially when you have one with such a long and rich tradition.
The superintendent of diocese schools, Dan Peters, knows better than anyone legal troubles have strained school budgets. But only 7 families enrolled in the freshman class at St. Mary's for next year. Not enough, he says, to keep the school open.
As much as the church wants to maintain its values, it's still like any other organization, has to be able to pay its bills. It's a matter of money.
The diocese has offered to bus St. Mary's students to O'Hara High School in Raytown or St. Pius X in the Northland. Meanwhile, the plan is to build a new school, St. Michael's, in Lee Summit in 2015. Jeff Scassolotti, a banker in Blue Springs who has a junior at St. Mary's now and who also graduated from the school, is skeptical the diocese can raise the $30 million it needs to build.
There's a lot of anger from a lot of people, and some people are done with it.
Done with?
Some are done with Catholic education. Some are done with the diocese. Some are even done with the church. I've had people say to me, I'm not giving another dime to the diocese, or at least not while that bishop's there.
A nationwide petition with more than 100,000 signatures has called for Bishop Finn's resignation. I met John Mulvey, a professional actor in Kansas City, at his favorite Waldo coffee shop. Mulvey went all through Catholic school in the diocese and on to Benedictine College in Atchison. He said he and his wife talked to their only son, then at school at St. Elizabeth, about the scandal in the Kansas City church.
We decided to continue to stay. We certainly let him know what was going on and our feelings, and it was around that time that I dropped out attending Mass under this bishop and under this pope.
Interestingly, at St. Patrick's Parish School, where the pornographic pictures were taken, enrollment hasn't tapered. There are those who tell me they took their kids out and will never return. There are others who say the incidents encouraged families at the parish to circle the wagons and to work to keep their school safe and strong. Sugar Creek Mayor Stan Salva has written the bishop asking him to reconsider the decision to close St. Mary's School. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
Well, we thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Zach Lewandowski and Monica Sandretsky. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.